Bringing you the latest case law updates on the legal aspects of law enforcement. This is Broadcast Blue.
Okay, and obviously, like I always say before I get started, it's important that I do the little legal disclaimer and note that this is purely an academic discussion, and no part of the presentation is presented as legal advice. I'm not offering it to you as legal advice, nor should it be construed as legal advice. And for any legal advice regarding this discussion, obviously, you need to consult with your attorney. Got an interesting kind of twist. Thanks for joining me today on Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar. And things are a little bit different. This special edition, In Search of the Reasonable Officer. This is the sixth edition in 2018. And I want to welcome you to this special edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar. I'm your host, Bruce Allen Barnard. And today I'm going a little off script with what I normally do with the Brown Bag webinars. As most of you know, I usually pick a recent case from one of the circuit courts, the United States Circuit Courts of Appeal, that has some applicability, typically Fourth Amendment, sometimes Fifth Amendment, but is generally applicable to law enforcement officers regarding the legal aspects of law enforcement. And then I dissect that case and talk about it. But that's not what's going to happen today. No case of the week today. The topic of today's webinar, I've entitled In Search of the Reasonable Officer, and I'm going to have a much longer podcast in the next couple of weeks that's going to go into a little bit more depth than I am here. So this is, I guess, a prelude. But no topic, when you're talking about the legal aspects of law enforcement today, there is no topic more prevalent than the use of force. And I've been doing this for well over 20 years. And I don't recall a time when there was so much discussion and so much apparent confusion over the wording contained in just the six very short pages of the Supreme Court decision in Graham versus Connor. And as most of you already know, Graham versus Connor is the gold standard for use of force decisions. And Graham, the court, formally adopted the Fourth Amendment analysis of the use of force over a Fifth and a 14th Amendment substantive due process analysis that had been adopted and historically had been used by the lower courts. And as a result, whether a particular officer's use of force is unconstitutional and therefore actionable under 1983 action under Title 42 of the United States Code, Section 1983, is determined by the reasonableness standard of the Fourth Amendment. So in this presentation, I want to provide you with a little historical perspective on the concept of the reasonable officer standard in use of force situations. And in order to do that, we really have to turn the clock back more than 20 years from the date of the Graham decision, which was in 1989. And this is because the reasonable officer standard has its roots in another very, very famous decision, which is the Terry versus Ohio decision. So let me, we're going to do a little bit of history here and kind of walk down the historical path to where we are today. Now, I'm not going to go into great detail in any of the cases we're going to discuss, and I assume that you're already familiar with the three cases primarily, and maybe the fourth that I'm going to talk about today, but I will touch on the facts briefly just to kind of make it clear why it is that it's so important that we talk about this. Most of you are already familiar with Terry versus Ohio and the two very important judicially recognized exceptions, what I call JREs, that the case created, the Terry stop and the Terry frisk. And indeed, the warrantless search and seizure conducted by Detective McFadden in Cleveland, Ohio, on that Halloween day in 1963, in that case, the warrantless search and seizure that he conducted against the three individuals, Terry, Chilton, and Katz, it was measured against the reasonableness of his actions under the Fourth Amendment. So it was a Fourth Amendment reasonableness standard or test that was applied. Let me read to you two very important sentences from that opinion, and they're consecutive. They come one right after the other. And this is a quote directly from Terry versus Ohio. "The scheme of the Fourth Amendment becomes meaningful only when it is assured that at some point the conduct of those charged with enforcing the laws can be subjected to the more detached, neutral scrutiny of a judge who must evaluate the reasonableness of a particular search or seizure in the light of the particular circumstances. And in making that assessment, it is imperative that the facts be judged against an objective standard. Would the facts available to the officer at the moment of the seizure or the search warrant of a man of reasonable caution in the belief that the action taken was appropriate?" Think about that. Think about that question. Would the facts available to the officer at the moment of the seizure or the search warrant a man of reasonable caution in the belief the action taken was appropriate? We're talking about an officer, the facts available to the officer and the officer making the decision. So although the court in Terry did not specifically mention the concept by name of reasonable officer concept, it applied the concept de facto by using an objective standard based on facts available to the officer at the moment of the seizure or the search. And since typically only law enforcement officers have the authority to search or seize, and it only stands to reason that the only people who would be confronted with this type of Fourth Amendment action would be law enforcement officers. So the reasonable person was a law enforcement officer in a law enforcement situation. And that was really kind of the start. The roots of the reasonable officer standard are there in that very famous decision in Terry, and very well referenced and mentioned in those two sentences. So now we need to flash forward to 1985. Now this is 4 years. We're going from 1967 to 1985, and we're still 4 years before Graham versus Connor was decided, which was 1989. We're talking 1985, the big 80s, when this decision came out. It was a lot of the big 80s were a great time for those of us who lived through them as young adults. But anyway, I digress. Enter Tennessee versus Garner, and recall the facts in Tennessee versus Garner. The facts took place in 1974, so it was nearly 11 years between the time the facts took place and the Supreme Court actually reached a decision, and things were a heck of a lot different back in the 70s back then. The facts in Tennessee versus Garner took place in 1974, 10 years before the decision was actually handed down. And in this case, the Tennessee versus Garner case, there were Memphis police officers. They were dispatched to answer a call from someone that said there was a prowler about. And when they arrived on the scene, they saw a woman standing on her porch, and she's pointing towards an adjacent house. And she told them she heard glass breaking and someone was breaking in next door. One of the officers went behind the house, heard a door slam, and then saw someone run across the backyard. The person, the suspect, stopped at this chain link fence. It was 6 feet high. It's a perimeter fence around the back of the yard. And the officer shined his flashlight on him, was able to see his face and his hands, and he saw no sign of that this person had a weapon. And he shouted out to the suspect. He told him to halt. He identified himself, police, halt. And they took a few steps toward him, and the suspect began to climb the fence. And the officer was convinced that if the suspect made it over the fence, he would elude capture. So we shot him, and he hit him in the head. He ended up dying. He died in the hospital, and they found on him that he had $10 and a purse that was taken from the house. That's what he had on his body, on his person, $10 and a purse that he'd stolen from the house. Now, for the younger folks, you're probably thinking to yourself, gosh, that was, there's no way we would do that today. There's no way that would happen now in the 2018. But you have to turn the clock back to 1974 in Tennessee. In Tennessee, like a very large number of states, including practically all of the southern states, had statutes on the books that allowed for this type of use of force. I used to know the exact number of states. I want to say that it was 36, but I can't recall. There were a large number of states that had statutes similar to the one in Tennessee. And the Tennessee statute provided that after a police officer has given notice of his intent to arrest a criminal suspect and the suspect flees or forcibly resists the officer, then the officer may use, and this is a quote, all necessary means, close quote, to effect arrest. Now, that includes deadly force. So what you need to understand is that in 1974, in a large number of states, the state statutes actually allowed for officers to shoot a fleeing arrestee, a fleeing suspect, after the police had identified themselves and given notice of their intent to arrest them. Stop, you're under arrest. And that was the law. Look, as of today's date, I'm 56 years old. I was a teenager in the 70s. I graduated from high school in 1979. I went to a high school in outside of Atlanta in Gwinnett County, Georgia, called Parkview High School. It's very close to a place called Stone Mountain. It's a beautiful park. Stone Mountain's a beautiful park. It's got a perimeter road all the way around the base of it with all kinds of places to park and picnic and enjoy huge expanses of grassy areas. And we did. On Sundays, when the weather was nice, we would all typically go to Stone Mountain Park and just hang out, being high school teenagers. Every high school had its own area, and we had our own little part of the park. We knew where all the different schools, as you drove around the base of Stone Mountain, you would know whether or not you were where Southwest DeKalb would be, or where Tucker would be, or where Berkmar would be, or any of the other high schools. And it was a nice environment. But also remember, in the 1970s, the drinking age was 18, which meant there were a large number of high school seniors who were able to legally buy beer. And so it wasn't uncommon for all of the high school teenagers thus gathered to be consuming the cheapest beer that high school money could buy on the Sunday at Stone Mountain Park. Well, the police, the Stone Mountain Park police, were ever vigilant in trying to prevent all of us, all right, let me change it, all of those underage high school students from drinking beer. And we would often be approached by the police while we were hanging out, throwing the Frisbee around. And let me tell you something. In 1978, when the police told you to freeze, you froze. I mean, today you go up to a group of kids and you say, police, freeze. You know, somebody screams popo and they all scram. But back in 1978, when police said freeze, you froze. And that's because Georgia, like Tennessee and a lot of other states, had statutes on the book that allowed for the use of all and any means necessary to arrest someone who was fleeing. And that included deadly force. So let's get back to Tennessee versus Garner. When confronted with the facts in the case, the United States Supreme Court held that the use of deadly force merely to stop someone who was fleeing arrest with nothing more was unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment, and therefore any statutes that permitted this type of the use of force were unconstitutional vis-a-vis the Fourth Amendment, as applied to the states via the 14th Amendment. So in 1985, all of the states that had statutes similar to that in Tennessee, they had to rewrite the books when it came to the use of deadly force to prevent an arrestee from escaping. So obviously there's a lot more to the Tennessee versus Garner decision than what I've just mentioned and referenced. But the relevant point for today's discussion is the fact that the Supreme Court was willing to look at least one particular type of force, a deadly force under the Fourth Amendment, and applying the Fourth Amendment standard instead of the prevailing Fifth Amendment substantive due process standard that was being applied. So notwithstanding Tennessee versus Garner, the overall standard for whether the use of force employed by a law enforcement officer in a particular situation was actionable under Title II of the United States Code, Section 1983, was based on the Fifth Amendment substantive due process standard as applied to the states by the 14th Amendment, and therefore was actionable under Section 1983 of Title 42 of the United States Code. So in 1973, the Second Circuit had issued a decision called Johnson versus Glick that created this four-part, four-prong, if you will, substantial due process test to all excessive force claims against law enforcement officers under a Section 1983 action, without considering whether that particular application of force might implicate a more specific constitutional right governed under a different standard like the Fourth Amendment or the Eighth Amendment. So after the Second Circuit issued this decision, the Glick decision, many other federal courts and circuits embraced the four-part Glick test. So prior to Graham versus Connor and the four Graham factors, we had the four Glick factors, the Fifth Amendment due process Glick factors. And the four Glick factors were, one, the need for the application of the force, two, the relationship between that need and the amount of force that was used, three, the extent of the injury inflicted, and four, and this is the important part, whether the force was applied in a good faith effort to maintain and restore discipline or maliciously and sadistically for the purpose of causing harm. It had to be one or the other, right? So you see, in order for a plaintiff in a 1983 action to prevail against the law enforcement officer for excessive use of force, under Glick, they would have to show the officer's application of the force was done maliciously and sadistically for the purpose of causing harm. And it's a subjective test. They would have to show what the mindset of the officer was and that it was done maliciously and sadistically for the purpose of causing harm. And since it was subjective, that taken with the level of maliciousness, it was a very, very high burden that very few plaintiffs in 1983 actions could actually meet. They just couldn't meet that burden. It was very, very high. And so we didn't have a whole lot of successful 1983 actions against law enforcement officers prior to Graham. So now the stage is set. We've gone through probably more than you've ever wanted to know about the background of what led into Graham and the whole concept. And I bet a lot of you didn't realize the reasonable officer standard was actually born in that Terry case. But now the stage is set for me to talk about Graham versus Connor and the reasonable officer standard. And again, I'm not going to go through all the facts of Graham versus Connor, because the purpose of the presentation isn't to teach you the rules for use of force. And if you're not familiar with Terry versus Ohio or Tennessee versus Garner or Graham versus Connor, I very strongly recommend that you read all those cases, start to finish. In fact, read them and then reread them. They're not that long. You'd be surprised how short they are, especially Graham versus Connor. As a quick refresher for Graham, remember in the case, DeThorn Graham was a diabetic. He was starting to have a diabetic episode, as he had low blood sugar. He asked his friend William Berry to take him to a convenience store and there in Charlotte, North Carolina. His actions, the way he ran into the store and ran out again because there was a long line, and taking off in the car to go somewhere else, his actions were observed by a Charlotte police officer who believed that he had just robbed the convenience store. And so the officer conducted a Terry stop, and he called for backup. And during the stop, Graham was detained. It eventually resulted in Graham being released without any charges. But during the detention and the use of force to effectuate the detention, he was injured, a broken foot and other injuries. He was struck in the head when he was thrown headfirst into the car. Through his attorney, Woody Kinnett, Mr. Graham brought a 1983 action against the officers who had used force against him, causing the injuries. And at the trial, the judge, the defendants, the police officer defendants in the case, through their attorney, motioned for a directed verdict. So basically, after the plaintiff, Mr. Graham, had presented all of his evidence, the defense attorneys for the officer said, hey, look, we want a directed verdict. And what that means is that as a matter of law, that they haven't even if you take all of the evidence that was presented by the plaintiff, they haven't met their burden of showing that the officers acted, remember, with that maliciousness. And the trial judge agreed under that Fifth Amendment standard of maliciousness. The trial judge directed the verdict in favor of the police officers, applying these Glick factors and holding that Mr. Graham had failed to establish the fourth prong, requiring him to show that the force was applied maliciously and sadistically for the very purpose of causing harm. So Mr. Graham appealed to the United States Supreme Court in a very famous, the famous decision for use of force, the biggie. And the United States Supreme Court embraced the concept that the court in Tennessee versus Garner had first brought up and then outright rejected the substantive due process standard requiring maliciousness in favor of this Fourth Amendment standard requiring the use of force to be reasonable. In citing Tennessee versus Garner, the Graham Court said, this is a quote, "Today we make explicit what was implicit in Garner's analysis and hold that all claims that law enforcement officers have used excessive force, deadly or not, in the course of an arrest," so it's all force, not just deadly force, "have used excessive force, deadly or not, in the course of an arrest, investigatory stop, or other seizure of a free citizen should be analyzed under the Fourth Amendment and its reasonableness standard rather than under the substantial due process standard." So the court went on, eliminated the four Glick factors for maliciousness and replaced it with the four Graham factors of reasonableness. Because reasonableness is a vague notion, right? They wanted to give something to go by. How do we determine whether or not degree of force is reasonable? And they gave us the four Graham factors, or three, depending on whether you combine the last two or not, like some people do. The severity of the crime, whether the suspect poses an immediate threat to the safety of officer or others, and whether the suspect is actively resisting arrest or attempting to evade arrest by flight. So then the court went on and cited Terry versus Ohio. The court went on to state that the reasonableness of a particular use of force must be judged from the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene rather than with the 20/20 vision of hindsight. That's a quote. And thus the court also made explicit what was implied in Terry, and that is the reasonable officer standard. And that the standard means that the Fourth Amendment is not violated if the officer makes a reasonable mistake. And the Supreme Court provided several examples. They said, for example, the Fourth Amendment is not violated by an arrest based on probable cause, even though the wrong person is arrested. They also said the Fourth Amendment is not violated by the mistaken execution of a valid search warrant on the wrong premises. And they also noted that with respect to a claim of excessive force, the same standard of reasonableness at the moment applies, and not every push or shove, even if later it may seem unnecessary in the peace of a judge's chambers, violates the Fourth Amendment. So this whole concept of the reasonable officer standard that was implied in Terry is now made explicit for use of force and a Fourth Amendment analysis under the Graham factors. And the court went on to say they use a very famous term called the calculus of reasonableness. And the court went on to say that the calculus of reasonableness must embody allowance for the fact that police officers are often forced to make split-second judgments in circumstances that are very tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving about the amount of force that is necessary in a particular situation. And the objective reasonableness inquiry focuses on the question of whether the officer's actions are objectively reasonable in light of the facts and circumstances confronting them without regard to underlying intent or motivation. And so it doesn't matter. It's not subjective. There's no subjectivity in it. Whereas under the Fifth Amendment Glick test, it was all subjective. Under the Graham test, it's all objective and not subjective. You know, I hear a lot of this on the radio. How many of you have ever heard one of these commentaries where they say, well, he was in fear for his life? That's not even relevant. That's not even relevant. It's neither necessary nor relevant in the Graham analysis because it's subjective. An officer doesn't have to be in fear in order to use any force. What an officer feels or thinks, what their underlying intent or motivation is not relevant to the question because it's an objective standard. So while Graham versus Connor made it easier for plaintiffs in excessive use of force cases under Section 1983 to survive either a motion for summary judgment or a directed verdict, it made allowances for the very unique situations that police officers confront when trying to effectuate these Fourth Amendment seizures. So now, as a result of Graham versus Connor, We have the Fourth Amendment applicability to claims of excessive use of force in 1983 actions, with the test being the objectively reasonable officer standard, applying the four Graham factors under a totality of the circumstances. And at first glance, that sounds really good for both the plaintiffs and for law enforcement. On its face, it recognizes that police officers have particular training and experiences, and they have a unique authority, which often requires them to use force against people that would, frankly, it would constitute an assault if it was used by anyone other than a law enforcement officer under his authority. So at the core of this recognition is the concept of the reasonable officer standard. It's not a reasonable person standard, because a layperson who is not a law enforcement officer would never be in a position of enforcing the law to the point that the Fourth Amendment would be implicated. So the rule recognizes that reasonableness must be based on a reasonable officer standard and without 20/20 hindsight. But there's a problem. And the problem isn't with the rule, with its calculus of reasonableness under the reasonable officer standard. The problem is with the application of the standard. In developing the rule, the court recognized that a layperson would not know or wouldn't understand what would be reasonable under a totality of circumstances for an officer effectuating a seizure of a person. If the court had made the standard a reasonable person standard instead of a reasonable officer standard, the resultant conclusions would often be unfair to law enforcement because of either ignorance or bias. So the reasonable officer standard, therefore, it's at the very heart of the Graham use of force determination. The reasonable officer standard is the core of the Graham use of force determination. But think about this. Who is it applying the standard when a lawsuit is filed and challenges are made? It's not police officers. It's judges and jury members, nearly all of whom have never spent 5 minutes in the shoes of a police officer. And how's that supposed to work effectively? I mean, if you wanted to know whether or not the actions of a neurosurgeon were reasonable, you'd measure their actions under the functional equivalent of a reasonable neurosurgeon standard. And this is often done when physicians are accused of questionable practices and are brought in front of a credentialing board for a hearing. I actually helped conduct one, not on the legal side of the house, not on the actual determination. So I got to witness a credentialing hearing firsthand. And when they have a credentialing hearing, a physician does something and the practice of what they've done is questionable. They're brought in front of this credentialing board, and the board isn't made up of 12 people randomly chosen from local voting pools, and it's not made up of judges or lawyers. The credentialing board's made up of other neurosurgeons who know what it is, what's reasonable and what's not reasonable for a neurosurgeon to do. And while law enforcement's not brain surgery, it is very unique with its own unique circumstances and responses to the circumstances. So how is a person who's never been a law enforcement officer, never had to make a vehicular stop at 2 o'clock in the morning on a dark road, never had to respond to a domestic violence 911 call, never had to respond to an armed assault and shots fired emergency call. How does a person without any experience whatsoever in law enforcement situations determine what's reasonable for a law enforcement officer to do in those situations? And that question isn't just rhetorical. I mean, it's an important question. It's an important question to answer because more and more that's the direction things have been headed. The inability of non-law enforcement officers and specifically appellate court judges to apply the reasonable officer standard has become readily apparent in recent decisions, especially qualified immunity decisions, where various circuit court decisions denying qualified immunity have been reversed by the United States Supreme Court. What's worse, many lay people have very unrealistic expectations of what police are capable of doing. And you can see this demonstrated all the time. Various news outlets, media outlets, with questions or comments like, why didn't they just shoot the gun out of his hand? Or why didn't they shoot him in the leg? He didn't have a gun. He had a knife and they shot him. And furthermore, there's a growing number who believe that 2020 hindsight should be employed. Think about that for a second. That 2020 hindsight should be employed. I want you to listen to something. So listen to this. It's only a minute.
I would suggest that the cops have to be right in fact, which is something we usually do not apply to the law.
What does that mean? In the scenario of a police person who's, does that mean like I need right that you don't have a toy gun?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah. So if you shoot me because you think I have a gun, I had best have a gun. And if I don't have a gun, your ass is going to jail because you were wrong. I don't care if you really thought so. I don't care if I was telling you I had a gun. If you are not right in fact, then you have to go to jail. I think that would be a standard that would allow us to prosecute these police officers.
But then a police person's gonna argue that like you don't understand the pressures that I'm under. It's a split second decision.
Sure. Monday morning quarterbacking. Sure. If you do what you just said, we're not gonna be able to do our jobs.
And I would say, fuck you, police officer. I'm sick of you. I would say, screw you. You have had your chance. Mm. You have had your chance to police my community without murdering us, and you have failed for 300 years. Enough. That's what I would say to that. More people might get hurt if I wasn't. I'm willing to risk that. I'm willing to try it that way then.
More people might get hurt. Do you understand? Do you understand what he's saying? What he just said? He's saying that if a police officer makes a use of force decision that with 2020 hindsight is incorrect, they don't just get sued under 1983. They get prosecuted and they go to jail. They get prosecuted and go to prison. So if some deranged person points an unloaded firearm or a toy gun that looks like a firearm at a police officer and says, I'm going to kill you, and the police officer shoots him and kills him, then the police officer is prosecuted for murder because he was not right in fact with 2020 hindsight. That the person you heard fully understands both the law and the implication of what he's saying. He understands and states that the rule will result in more people getting hurt. He said that at the very end. More people will get hurt. And that's because he's acknowledging that there will be no police. And how are more people going to get hurt? More people are going to get hurt because there won't be any police officers around. After all, who in their right mind would be a police officer if what he is proposing was the rule of law regarding their use of force? Nevertheless, he thinks that America would be a better place with absolutely no police officers. Let me tell you what makes this really scary. I mean, really, really scary. This isn't an uneducated person with zero understanding of the law making this comment. The person you hear in this audio clip, his name is Eli Mistal, and he's the legal editor for an NPR podcast produced by WNYC in New York called More Perfect. It's a part of the Radiolab podcast family. He is the legal editor. He's a lawyer. He has an undergraduate degree in American government and a law degree, both from Harvard University. And his commentary and his dialogue isn't just ridiculous and irresponsible, it's dangerous. It's exactly the kind of rhetoric that leads people to hunt down and murder police officers. And this is the kind of stuff that you have. This is on NPR. And by the way, I sought and received permission to play that clip. And so I need to acknowledge the fact that that was a clip from one of the podcast episodes on More Perfect called Mr. Graham, the Reasonable Person. Anyway, very, very scary. The reasonable officer standard is incredibly important. Unfortunately, it appears that in our current political climate, many politicians and no small number of prosecutors and now judges seem either unwilling or unable to acknowledge it. Only time's going to tell how this pans out for us, not just for law enforcement officers, but for all of us as Americans. Very interesting set of dynamics going on in the country today, especially when it comes to the use of force. Today's edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar is brought to you by Leah One. Leah One provides online training for law enforcement officers, providing the latest in the legal aspects of law enforcement. You can check them out at www.lea.one.